You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, a little-known legal theory is about to have its day before the U.S. Supreme Court. It was an argument used by Donald Trump's legal team during the effort to overturn the 2020 presidential election. On today's 1A, find out what it is and why critics fear it could upend the way federal elections are run and certified. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, as thousands of people in Wisconsin await their criminal trial, some are sitting in jail, sometimes for months. Once charged with a crime, many people are given a large cash bail, which requires them to either pay and be released or not pay and wait for trial in jail. Cash bail started as an incentive to ensure people will show up for their trial. It's become an issue in the midterm elections here in Wisconsin and around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of our current system of cash bail? Do you think amounts are set too high or not high enough? Would you like another way to ensure people are showing up for their trials and to protect public safety? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Christine Scott Hayward is director and associate professor at the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at California State University, Long Beach. With sociologist Joshua Page, Christine researched the impact of cash bail in the U.S. and possible changes to the system. Christine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with the basics of what cash bail is and why it's there. What is the intent of cash bail systems?
Well, cash bail was originally envisaged as a way to get people to show up for their trial or any other court hearings that they have. And so you use the term incentive. It's sort of a guarantee, right? There's this idea that if somebody has money on the line, they're going to be more likely to show up at trial. So those are sort of the origins. You don't need cash to have bail. So there can also be other ways, property bonds, et cetera. But it is the dominant way that people are released from jail pre-trial in the U.S.
In the public conversation, in political campaigns, the issue of public safety comes up a lot. Has it been, what is it the goal of the cash bail system to protect public safety, to make sure that people aren't out of jail committing crimes while they're waiting for their trial?
So that is part of the bail system, and that was introduced into the U.S. in the 1980s. Until then, appearance at trial was the primary reason, but after that, public safety did become part of the conversation too. And so typically, if you want to deny bail, if you want to deny somebody pretrial release because there is a risk to public safety, you go through a special procedural hearing where, you know, the prosecutor has to demonstrate typically by clear and convincing evidence that there's a risk that they'll cause harm to a member of the public. And it's a lot more difficult to make that showing in that kind of hearing than it is to simply set a bail that's so high that a person is not going to be able to make it, and thus they're sort of going to be de facto detained, if that makes sense.
Sure. Well, and this became a big topic in Wisconsin about a year ago when Daryl Brooks had paid bail for previous alleged offenses, was released from jail, and then drove into a Christmas parade in Waukesha, killing six, injuring more. That bail for previous crimes had been set originally at $1,000. A lot of people saying that wasn't high enough to protect public safety. These high-profile cases definitely enter into the debate a lot. What is your take on that and how it compares to, I guess, how cash bail normally works?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely sort of the exception to the rule, right? In most, and $1,000 may seem like a low bail to some extent, especially when you compare it to $5 million. But $1,000 is a lot of money for most people, particularly sort of the low-income people that tend to be caught up in the criminal legal system in the United States. And so I'll say a couple of things. One is that, you know, the vast majority of people who are released, whether they're on bail or some other mechanism, will show up for their court hearings. Most will not commit a crime while they're out on pretrial release. And if they do commit a crime, it's unlikely to be a violent crime. So there always are going to be sort of the exceptions where you have, you know, somebody like Mr. Brooks committing a serious violent crime while out on pretrial release. But for the most part, most people are you know, going to do what they're supposed to do, which is show up at their court hearings. Sorry, I lost my train of thought.
That's okay. Well, I wanted to ask now, we've seen movements to reform bail, and interestingly, liberal and conservative groups getting together, including some conservative groups backed by the Koch brothers, saying, hey, let's reform this. So we've seen some states overhaul their cash bail systems, get rid of them in recent years. Do we have a sense of how, whether that's affected things like public safety and whether people are showing up for their trial dates?
Yeah, we haven't. I mean, it's early days yet. So the, you know, most of these reforms have been happening over the last few years, but early data suggests that there hasn't been a significant decrease in public safety, and you don't see lower rates of people showing up at trial. And so the reason, of course, why most people want to get rid of cash bail is because it discriminates against poor people, right? So a cash bail system basically says, you know, whether or not you get to get out of jail pending trial is based on your income and not typically on your risk or whether there's a risk of failure to appear at trial or a risk of committing a new offense. And so, you know, the consequences of that are great, right? There's so much evidence at this point demonstrating that, you know, if you are detained pending trial, you know, you're more likely to be convicted, you're more likely to plead guilty, and to plead guilty much earlier, right, because you want to escape sort of the pretty bad jail conditions that exist in many jails. But you're also, if you're convicted, you're more likely to get a longer sentence, you're more likely to get a sentence to incarceration. And so that's sort of why so many reformers have been, you know, pushing for an elimination of cash bail.
We're talking to Christine Scott Hayward at the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at California State University, Long Beach, looking at bail, cash bail, possible changes to the system in Wisconsin and around the country. You could join in with your questions, your thoughts, maybe your experiences on one side or another of the cash bail system at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. John joins us now in Elkhorn. John, hi.
Hello. I totally agree with your guess. I actually spent about 18 months in jail waiting on a trial because I couldn't afford the bail. Why doesn't Wisconsin have bail bonds like a lot of other states have, where then you only have to come up with like 10 or 15% of the bail and the bail bondsman comes up with the rest?
John, thanks for that call. And that is something, I don't know about unique, but an exception here in Wisconsin. We don't, as I understand it, have that bail bond system. How common is that, Christine?
It's uncommon. Most states have the bail bond system, which is, as the caller said, allow you to deposit typically 10%. I don't know if Wisconsin has something similar to what Illinois used to have, which is where you could do the 10% payment, but it went to the court rather than to a bail bond agency. And so, bail, you know, commercial bail is controversial. The only two countries in the world that have commercial bail are the United States and the Philippines. And it's been criticized for a variety of reasons. You know, while it is true that in some cases, you know, being able to pay 10%, which is a much smaller amount, will allow somebody to get out of jail. But that 10%, they'll never get back, right? That 10% is a payment for the privilege of the bail agency putting up the bail for them. There's also been a lot of stories about corruption in the bail industry. And the bail industry is supported by, you know, large insurance companies that make a lot of money from, you know, poor people. So it's a balance. On the one hand, yes, it does make it easier for some people to get out. But on the other hand, as part of a sort of a larger systemic issue, it's problematic.
And John brings up another really interesting point, Christine. He said he waited in jail a year and a half till his trial. If I'm having to wait in jail for a week because I can't pay my bail, I mean, that's not great, but it's a week. But our court systems in many cases are backed up and these trials take a long time. How big a factor in this discussion is that?
Yeah, I mean, it is a big factor. You know, there are, you know, in theory, there are speedy trial rules, which generally require shorter periods of time if you're detained than if you're in the community. But for a variety of reasons, that doesn't usually help people. And I will say, though, that, you know, even a week in jail can really have strong negative impacts on, you know, on people who are detained, you know, losing jobs, losing custody of their kids. You know, there's lots of horrible stories about, you know, people who have been subjected to violence while they're in jail, committed suicide. And 18 months is a long time, but we also have stories of people who spend 3 years and even longer while they're in there.
Well, thanks again for that call, John. We're talking to Christine Scott Hayward, director of the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at California State University, Long Beach. We're looking at cash bail in Wisconsin and around the United States. Reforms may be in the works and pushback against those reforms. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see higher cash bail in Wisconsin, especially maybe for people accused of more violent crimes? Or do you think we need to get rid of the cash bail system altogether or some point in between? Call in on 800-642-1234, and will a politician's opinion on cash bail and bail reform affect the way you vote? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with Christine Scott Hayward, director of the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at California State University, Long Beach. Talk with her about her recently published research on cash bail and the criminal justice system. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Have you or someone you know been through the cash bail system? Were you able to pay it, or were you stuck in jail waiting for a trial? Do you want to see the system change in one way or another? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go back to your calls now. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus.
Hi, Rob. How are you today?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Marcus?
Okay, so I think that, like, with pretty much everything in this world, it's worth taking a second look at and seeing if there is, you know, a possible better way. I would say that some reforms are necessary what they are. I don't know exactly. My concern is with getting rid of the no cash bail is you could literally have people who are innocent that were upstanding members of society sitting in jail because they couldn't pay the cash bail, because lots of us are living paycheck to paycheck. And so then while they're in there, they lose their job, they lose their apartment, perhaps their girlfriend, significant other, whatever. You know, they lose their property, they lose their car, you know, and then they're coming out in a situation where it's like, I already lost all this for a crime I didn't commit simply because I couldn't bail out. And I don't think that's right either.
Marcus, thanks for that call. Christine, Marcus worried about the impact this might have someone, especially someone ultimately acquitted in a trial of that long period in jail.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's absolutely right. Those are many of the consequences. And there's no compensation, right? There's no compensation for that time that you spend in there. And we have cases of people who've spent years waiting for a trial and then eventually, you know, charges are dismissed. Many people have heard of the case of Khalif Browder, who was a 16-year-old when he was arrested and spent 3 years in Rikers Island in New York, where he was, you know, abused, spent a lot of time in solitary confinement. He kept being offered plea deals, you know, just plead guilty, this low-level offense, and then you can get out. Then they'd offer him another one. He kept saying, no, I didn't do anything. I'm not pleading guilty to a crime I didn't commit. Ultimately, the prosecutors just dropped the charges, after which he'd spent 3 years in jail. And sadly, 3 months later, he committed suicide. And that's a particularly horrible story. But, you know, as the caller said, the consequences are severe.
Thanks for that call, Marcus, at 800-642-1234. Karen joins us now in Luck. Karen, hi.
Hey, thanks for having this conversation. I work with a lot of people who are coming out of incarceration and who are in recovery, and many of them were put in jail because of felony bail jumping. And that seems to me to be a poor person's crime, and it should be unconstitutional, but it's not. And I'm wondering what kinds of things can we do legislatively to correct this?
Karen, thanks for the call. Christine, do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I'll say I'm not an expert on Wisconsin law, but I am aware of that in Wisconsin, unlike in other places, that offense is a felony rather than a misdemeanor, which can exacerbate some of the issues described earlier. I think it just does come back to the fact that, you know, these are crime, you know, that's a crime, and this system essentially, as I've said before, discriminates against poor people. You know, you have examples of people who've been given an extremely high bail and just sort of say, hey, I don't need that money. I'm just going to, you know, abscond, leave it behind and move on. And, you know, the small amounts that some people say, you know, that are too small, as I said before, are just very difficult for people to pay. And so people are left with a choice of, you know, I think I'm innocent, or I think I have a really good chance of fighting this offense and maybe getting a good deal, but I can either, you know, plead guilty now and get out and perhaps not have too much of an interruption to my life, or I can sit here and wait and hope that I'll be able to achieve that outcome.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Christine Scott Hayward, criminal justice expert at California State University, Long Beach, looking at bail, cash bail in particular, what the system looks like, how it works, possible changes. Still time for you to share your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Christine, focusing in on the public safety example, you mentioned that there is a way to say, okay, this person who's awaiting trial, we think represents a very significant danger if they were at large. Is there a way to improve that system, make it work better, and uncouple it from the cash bail system so that the sort of the backdoor solution isn't, okay, you're dangerous, so we're going to set, you know, a $5 million cash bail to make sure you can't get out?
Yeah, I mean, that system exists in the majority of states. And, you know, to my knowledge, it is the same system that operates in Wisconsin. So they shouldn't be separate. But what I know from talking to you know, some people who work in this system itself is that it's just a lot easier to set a high bail. The standards, as I said before, are much lower. You know, they're also, it's difficult to sort of prove and predict whether one particular individual is actually going to pose a danger, right? We're making educated guesses most of the time based on factors that tend to predict things, but that, you know, we can never really know about one particular individual. You know, Illinois, in its reforms that go into effect next year, sort of narrowed their exception. So in Illinois now, you actually have to demonstrate that there's a specific threat to a specific person, which will make it a little harder to detain people in that way. You know, I think that makes it a little better in some ways, but then you could also argue, well, you know, if it's harder to do it that way, then we're going to revert to the other system if that's still on the books.
Now, the politics of this make it a very touchy subject. As I mentioned, there were some bipartisan efforts at reform for a while there. Then an election season comes along and crime becomes a hot button issue. Do you see a change and progress happening in fits and starts because of that kind of politics?
Yeah, I mean, like anything in the criminal legal system, politics matters. And when crime goes up, everybody's trying to explain sort of why, you know, why did crime jump? What are some of these, you know, we made these reforms. Did any of those reforms have a particular impact? And it's very difficult to make that connection, but it's sort of an easy target. I think one thing I would say is that, you know, the places that have been sort of successful, like New Jersey, have had buy-in from, you know, most agencies and sort of a wider coalition. And you have to be ready to sort of, you know, there are going to be those cases, right? There's always going to be the exception, you know, where somebody who is released, you know, under a no bail system, you know, then does something bad. But I think we have to remember that unless we lock, you know, everybody up, including all of the innocent people, you know, you're never going to be 100% secure. And also remember that people can still commit offenses while they are locked up, right?
Bring on another caller now. Petra is with us in La Crosse. Petra, hi.
Hi. So my question or my comment is that people can be charged with any, you know, any crime for very little evidence and then sit in jail for long periods of time if they can't cash bond out. And I'm just wondering what she thinks about that.
Petra, thanks for the call. What do you think, Christine?
I think she's absolutely right. So let's remember that in order to charge somebody, the standard is probable cause, right? Which is a fair probability that a crime is being committed and that this person committed the crime. It's a not particularly high standard, right? So you can sit in jail based on a probable cause standard when, you know, at trial or, you know, at when a person pleads guilty, the standard is beyond a reasonable doubt. And there's a big gap between those two things. We know that for any particular act, you know, you could charge it as any number of things. I mean, I sat in on a bail hearing once that involved a woman who'd gotten into a fight at a bar. The police showed up. She ended up sort of pushing the police officer, and then somehow she ended up, you know, charged with multiple counts of, you know, felony assault of a police officer, right? You could charge that crime in a very different way, and the likelihood of her being convicted of that particular charge later down the road is probably unlikely. And so I think the caller is correct that, you know, the standard is pretty low in terms of, you know, what we need to actually charge somebody with.
Thanks for that call, Petra. In just our last minute or so, Christine, what for you are the big unanswered questions about our cash bail system that maybe future research could help resolve?
Yeah, I mean, I think we still don't know a lot about the alternatives, right? So we have some information coming in, but most states haven't abolished it entirely. And we also don't know whether the alternatives that have been proposed are going to be effective. So, you know, you can just release people on their own recognizance and then provide them services like, you know, notifications, text reminders that their court appearance is coming up, provide some sort of, you know, services if there's needs that relate to their appearance. Risk assessment has become popular, and there's some evidence that that does help reduce the number of people locked up, but there are also problems with risk assessment. So I think, you know, we need more states to sort of actually take the leap and abolish cash bail, because, you know, most of the evidence that we have so far suggests that it's not going to have a negative impact on public safety or appearance rates. But we only have that evidence for a few years from a few states.
Christine, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Christine Scott Hayward, director and associate professor at the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at California State University, Long Beach. She joined us today to talk about her research on cash bail. You can still share your thoughts on cash bail itself and the politics that surround it in an election year. Email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, find out why some Wisconsin communities are considered as food deserts with limited access to affordable and healthy food. And check out some of the latest efforts to get food to where it's needed. And some states have a binding statewide referendum process to change laws. Wisconsin doesn't. Should we? We'll look at the pros and cons, and you can tell us what you think. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to the director of the Bureau of Aging and Disability Resources in Wisconsin for guidance on how to navigate the challenges of housing for seniors. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Milwaukee's mayor says the state's system for funding local services isn't working. We'll talk to two researchers who have studied shared revenue, how it works, and the impact it has on towns and cities like yours all over the state. First, the Fox Valley is one of the areas in Wisconsin seeing a growing new trend in senior living. They're called granny pods. Companies are building small external living quarters onto single-family properties, either as standalone structures or attached to an existing home. The idea is to give seniors the independence of living on their own while still being close to loved ones. It's not an option for everyone, but it highlights the ways that seniors and their families are dealing with the difficulties of finding senior housing. Our next guest has some guidance for how to navigate housing for our aging population, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Is this something you're dealing with right now as a senior yourself or someone working with a family member? What challenges are you seeing in the world of senior housing that covers a lot of territory? What kind of things are you looking for? Are you finding them in your area? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Carrie Mulkey is director of the Bureau of Aging and Disability Resources in the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Carrie, thanks for joining us today.
Good afternoon. It's great to be with you.
Now, this was new to me. Have you seen much about these so-called granny pods or other similar sort of add-on housing alternatives for seniors?
I have. They've actually been around for quite some time, but I would say that as of late, these have they're becoming more popular as families are recognizing the benefits of having an older family member close by and as people are seeking low-cost alternatives.
Again, that's just one option. And a tricky thing talking about senior housing is that could cover everything from, you know, someone requiring a lot of regular, you know, medical check-ins and things like that to somebody living completely independently and all points in between. Can you talk about some of the variety of senior housing options people might be looking for?
Absolutely. So one of the you know, just calling out a challenge right away that I see is that I think there's a longstanding public perception that when we get old, we need to leave the place we're in and live somewhere else. And we have this image of the place, and it's not very pleasant sometimes. So along with this can come a stirring fear of loss and dread towards growing old, an assumption that as we grow old, we're going to lose our comfort and loss of home and loss of freedom and independence. But the reality is that there are a whole lot of options, including options for the home. For some people, it's as simple as moving a bedroom to the main floor, installing grab bars in the bathroom, removing rugs and things like that, making simple home modifications that can make a home safe for a long time, frankly, for a number of older adults. But then there's other older adults, of course, because we're also very diverse, that need a little bit more care and support. And the care and support can be provided in our own homes, and it can also be provided in facility-based care and with other community resources.
Now, we hear about a tough housing market lately for anybody. Forget about the age, high costs in some cases, a lack of availability. Is that making senior housing more of a challenge?
It certainly is, although in some parts of our state, actually, there's an abundance of certain types of facilities, like assisted living facilities, for example. But let me talk about costs for a minute, because I think, you know, that definitely we've been seeing that in all markets, and that is very true in senior living as well, across provider types, actually, of long-term care services and facilities. We are seeing steadily increasing costs. In fact, just last year, or the latest data we have from 2020 to 2021, we saw a 5% increase in the cost of assisted living facilities and adult day services across the country, and a 2% increase in nursing home costs. Now, those percentages may not sound big, but I don't know that everybody realizes how expensive some of these places can run. So, for example, a nursing home in Wisconsin can cost about $117,000 a year, and that would be for a private room, and even for a shared room or a semi-private room, that can run $108,000. Assisted living facilities are a little less expensive, but can still service sticker shock for people who see, you know, the annual median there is $54,000 per year, or about $4,600 a month. So the cost is steep in general, and the more that those costs, you know, increase, the harder it is for people to even consider some of these facilities, at least privately paying for them.
We're talking to Carrie Mulkey, Director of the Bureau of Aging and Disability Resources at Wisconsin's Department of Health Services, talking about senior living options, a wide variety. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Is this your life right now? If you're getting older, trying to plan, you know, what's my next step? Where am I going to live next? Or can I make my current housing situation work as I get older? Looking at different facilities, are you a family member helping someone else deal with these things, search things out, make the decisions, share your experiences or your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Carrie, suppose somebody is just starting this process, a senior, maybe working with their family, saying, okay, I like my house, but I see a point in the next couple of few years where I'm going to need to move out of here and something else. Can you define some of the options? Like, we hear a lot of different phrases like assisted living. Can you tell us a few of the different things that are maybe next steps and what they involve?
I really appreciate this question, because this is the time that it's really important to talk about it prior to needing some of these services and supports. One thing I would say is that you don't need to do this alone. And Wisconsin has a really amazing resource, in fact, uniquely Wisconsin, called Aging and Disability Resource Centers. And they are available in every single community across the state. So I encourage you, if you are starting to think about what options are available to you locally, because I can talk about statewide options, and I'll do that in just a second. But each community has different resources available, and that Aging and Disability Resource Center in your community can help you sort through your own options, your own scenario, your own situation, and link you with what's available locally. So I encourage listeners to go to findmyadrc.org, and you'll be able to find contact information for your local resource center. That said, prior to contacting them, or you know, even if you don't reach out to them, I do think it's really helpful to understand what some of those options are that are available to you. So starting from the services that can be brought into people's homes. I mentioned home modifications a little bit earlier. So sometimes just, you know, one-time services like that, where it's a one-time cost, you can install grab bars and so on. But then you can also pay for things like personal care, which can help people with activities of daily living and the some of the chore services that get a little harder as we age. So all of those and more are available in for people to stay in the home that they're in. Then for people who are maybe interested in leaving, that, you know, is sometimes people want to get out of their home as they age or as things change. So assisted living is an umbrella term that we use. There's actually different types of assisted living in the state, and they have different regulations associated with them. We have community-based residential facilities, and which tend to be one room within a broader space, not always. But then we also have residential care apartment complexes, and the name gives it away. They're apartments, so these are places that have a little bit more space for people to live in. There's also smaller living arrangements, adult family homes, which is also a regulated setting. It tends to include people, three to four people that are living together and receiving care services in a home. I'm glad that you mentioned the ideas of granny flats or mother-in-law suites, the pods, you know, that people can you know, put on site, perhaps of, you know, a family member. So there really are a whole lot of options, and the options vary across the state, and you don't have to do this alone. So reach out to those who can help facilitate this for you.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Sarah is with us now in Whitewater. Sarah, hi.
Hi, how are you today? Thank you so much for this topic. It's so on point with what my husband and I are going through right now. We've made a lot of modifications to the home to make things easier for him as he faces mobility issues. And we have not feared our next move by doing proper planning. And this is so on point for so many people. You don't have to leave your home. You absolutely don't. And if you do, my husband and I have decided we do need to go to a more temperate climate. We've turned it into something that's very exciting and planning to downsize into an area where there are same amenities that I can find in our beautiful home state of Wisconsin, and yet a little better tempered climate for the two of us, and surrounded by health care and surrounded by those things that he will eventually need. It certainly doesn't have to be scary as long as you plan ahead and treat it like the big adventure that it is.
Sarah, thanks so much for sharing that. Congrats on the planning. Maybe we can set up a cheese care package for you, because the cheese, wherever you're going, isn't going to be as good. But Carrie, a big thumbs up, I imagine, to Sarah's message of planning to make it less scary.
Oh, I love it. I love it so much. I wish I could change the climate. That isn't something I can offer up. But I agree with Sarah wholeheartedly. And I think, you know, what she raises for me too, which is an important point that I like to make in any presentation I give, is that We really need to change how we view aging. And it's instead of having it be a scary thing, something we fear, something we dread, there's a whole lot of benefit that comes from growing old, not just from an individual point of view, but our communities can benefit so much from having a growing aging population, which of course is happening in this state and all across the nation and the world, frankly.
Sarah, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Carrie Mulkey, Director of the Bureau of Aging and Disability Resources at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, looking at the challenges and the opportunities when it comes to finding housing for seniors in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been in the market looking for your next step or helping maybe a parent or other loved one do the same? What has worked for you? What challenges have you found? Have you found ways to overcome those challenges? Do you have questions for our guest? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Carrie Mulkey, Director of the Bureau of Aging and Disability Resources in Wisconsin's Department of Health Services. She's with us today with guidance on navigating housing for seniors, the different considerations we face when it comes to affordability, independence, health care needs, and more. You can still join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had an experience lately with the senior housing market? Are you making decisions right now for yourself or helping a loved one along? Are you finding things that you need where you need them? Or if you had to move, what are some of the biggest challenges you've encountered? Call in now at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your experiences, or your questions. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Carrie, I think something a lot of families encounter at one point or another is, you know, as we get older, maybe I can live just fine independently, but I'm hitting a point where driving isn't an option anymore. And that can be, I think, a thing that drives an end to that sort of housing independence for some people. Are there ways around that? Are there ways to help people stay in their home when they in their post-driving career?
I appreciate this question because I often frame transportation as our entree into the world. So it is really important, especially with isolation and loneliness, you know, that can come with aging too. So this is a big policy area that we work on a regular basis. There are some communities that have different resources for transportation, whether it's public transportation or paratransit options. But for rural areas, it gets to be a little more challenging. So I do know that there's a lot of communities that have set up different mechanisms for driving folks together. And a lot of volunteerism is something that we're always looking for. So people who are willing to volunteer some of their time to drive family and friends around, community members, you know, even people they don't know, but, you know, who understand the importance of getting around and how important transportation is. So I think, you know, the other piece, too, is that we assume that people I think, you know, losing your driver's license or, you know, out of concern, there's a lot of fear about losing your driver's license. And I think sometimes we take that driver's license away too soon. So I think it's important to have a true sense of where family members are at in terms of driving. And again, knowing what your options are, should you be struggling or when it is time perhaps to, you know, give up the keys and find other ways to get around.
Now, another challenge people may see, and I've seen this in my own family over the years, you know, say a couple, one spouse is developing more and more healthcare needs past the point where their spouse can really do that for them, but maybe short of the point where they want to go and live in some kind of assisted care facility. Are there things out there to help people with, you know, some sort of in-home care?
Absolutely. There are many, many, many options for that. And, you know, first let me just say thank you to all of the people who are serving as caregivers out there. In fact, that is the biggest way that long-term care services are being provided, is it's from spouses and other family members. And so one thing I want to add quickly is that, there is support for caregivers because we acknowledge and understand how important their role is. And so ways to avoid that burnout, ways to avoid some of the physical, you know, issues that can come if we have to help with transporting somebody and physically, you know, with mobility issues and those sorts of things. So first, reach out if you are a caregiver that, you know, is struggling. We do want to help you to sustain you in that role and find happiness in that space. If it gets to be to the place, of course, where you physically can't do it anymore, mentally, emotionally, all those things that can occur. Again, there's just a number of in-home services that can assist you in, again, whether it's things like help around the house or mowing the lawn or a lot of those daily sorts of activities that we have to do to stay in our own homes and also to care for ourselves. So this home health care is readily available in many parts of the state. One thing I'd also mention is that we are, some people frame it as a crisis, and I guess I would echo that in that we are actually losing a number of people in our direct care workforce for both home care services and in facility-based care. So this is another big policy, you know, question that we're working towards. Last, what I would say is, it's okay to rely on our neighbors. I think we need to do that a little more. Being good community members and you know, building relationships across our neighborhoods can also be a tremendous source of help for caregivers or people especially where there's one person who really needs help and another person who's providing that level of care for someone.
Let's go back to our callers with Bruce on the line in Green Bay. Hi, Bruce.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Bruce?
Well, I was long-term care insurance. I've paid the same policy for 10 years, my wife and I, at the same rate. Now, they send me a letter telling me in the next 3 years I can expect a 75% increase in my premiums. That doesn't seem right.
Bruce, thanks for the call. Bruce, having long-term care insurance, seeing his policies go up, Carrie, is that something you've been running into?
Absolutely, and I am not an expert in long-term care insurance, I will admit, but I do know that there are some pieces of advice I guess I would have for your callers related to this, is that I think it's really important to, of course, read the fine print, as it is with most things that we're purchasing. We do know that sometimes, so it's not just about increasing costs, but sometimes the long-term care insurance doesn't cover what people think it will cover. So for example, some long-term care insurance doesn't cover home care. So as we've been talking about that a lot here in the last half an hour, there are some policies that don't cover, you know, all the benefits and some of the options that people want to choose or select when it comes time to use their long-term care insurance. So here too, there are people who can help you sort through some of this, and you can find them at the Aging and Disability Resource Center. Benefit specialists are the position title, so to speak, of the folks that can help you sort through a lot of those issues before you make purchases or over time if you have questions about them.
Bruce, thanks for that call. And Carrie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Carrie Mulkey, Director of the Bureau of Aging and Disability Resources in the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. She was with us today to help us with some of the top considerations and challenges facing people looking for all the different kinds of senior housing. We heard got a note, Stella in Sturgeon Bay called in, couldn't stay on the line. Strongly recommends finding caregiver support networks in your area if you're someone who is providing care for a spouse or other loved one in this situation. She says seek out these caregiver support groups. And you could still share your own, maybe, suggestions for others. If you've learned a lesson, found a great support in your area, tell us about it. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page and let us and everybody else know about it. Coming up after the news, we'll take a close look at Wisconsin's shared revenue system that helps fund local government services like libraries and fire stations. A lot of local leaders in cities and towns around the state saying they may not be getting their fair share of revenue that goes to the state level. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.